Hello, and welcome to This Week in the Ancient Near East, the podcast that takes archaeology exactly as seriously as it deserves. I'm Alex Jaffe, director of the Bob and Ray Institute of Archaeology at the University of Southern North Dakota at Hoople. As has long been the norm, I am joined by two real academics from actual institutions, Professor J.P. Dussel of the University of Tennessee and Professor Rachel Hallett of the State University of New York at Purchase. We're coming to you from the Joey Heatherton Sleep Studies Clinic here on the beautiful Hoople campus. Today we're talking about something familiar to everyone, beds and sleeping. But applying these categories to the past isn't easy. First of all, what is a bed? Is it a mat, a futon, a rug, or just a roof, floor, or bench? You had a bench? Why, when I was growing up? Or was it just wherever you lay down and went to sleep? And how do you tell archaeologically if something was a bed if it changed functions at different times of day? How was sleep organized anyway? Historical and ethnographic evidence shows that all sorts of things go on in the middle of the night. No, not just that, but actual activities that count as work or culture, like telling stories. But again, how can we tell if someone was napping flint in the middle of the night or the middle of the day? And did the need to get a good night's sleep drive technological change? Take pillows, for example. All sorts of other questions come to mind, but does any of this matter? Does a better understanding of sleep in the past bring us closer to understanding people, allowing us to snuggle up with them, so to speak? As usual, we have more questions than answers, but the real question is, were there waterbeds in the ancient Near East? This topic really got me thinking. So I don't have one lightning round. I have seven, but we don't have to do all of them. All related to the topic du jour. Do you sleep with the TV on?
I do.
Well, hold it. Let's introduce at least the topic. The topic is beds. Beds through the centuries.
Bed through the centuries. Sleep through the centuries.
A recent article in the BBC that talks about interesting beds throughout history. And we have some very good examples from the Near East and the classical world. And, sleep being what it is, seems like a good topic.
Yeah.
But do you sleep with the TV on?
No. I don't have a TV. Who has a TV anymore?
We have TVs. Yeah. Alex, do you?
Oh, God, no. It's the most irritating thing. Yeah. And just seeing the flashing, it's like it disrupts my circadian rhythms through my eyelids.
Yeah.
All right.
I need a double set of eyelids like Vulcans have.
Or camels.
Or camels. Yeah.
Like, camel lids.
Give us another.
Well, that's why they call it camel lid.
Wow. Right. Give us another short lightning round out of your seven.
Did you ever own a waterbed?
No.
I've never owned one, but I've had access to one. many years ago when waterbeds were not quite seen as the velour of the of the popular culture.
I actually owned one.
Whoa, really?
In Tucson. I had one. It was the first year that I lived there. But it was one of the cheap ones that's basically like a gigantic baggie. The expensive ones have stuff inside, so it's not quite so wavy. But this was just like sleeping on a big old bag of water.
Was there any temperature modulation, or was it literally just room temp?
I think there might have been a heater, but I don't know that we used it. but it's very weird because you kind of sink down, and draining it took about 2 days.
But oh God.
Couldn't put it on my second on the apartment on the second floor. For obvious structural reasons.
Wow.
That's probably why they didn't have water bags in antiquity.
Oh, that's why.
Yeah, that and not having invented plastic and not having a sheep's bladder or cow's bladder big enough.
Well, they sewed them all together. Probably could have been done. Well, that's an archaeological question for our Rachel? Listener to ponder.
Hold on, we have to get Rachel's response.
To waterbeds, I have slept on waterbeds. I have never owned a waterbed, and the kind I slept on was also just the big bag of water. And they didn't really have so much water in the ancient Near East to waste it on a giant bed. I'll just throw that in.
Yeah.
Well, that's a separate topic. in our second hour, the hydrodynamics of waterbed use in the ancient Near East. But I thought that this was a very interesting topic, the topic of beds, which leads you to sleep. And the question of sleeping and where you sleep and where you slept in the ancient Near East. And I've been thinking about it, and I only can think of maybe two examples of actual beds from the ancient Near East.
From the ancient Near East, okay.
From the ancient Near East. One is from Gordian, mm-hmm. which I think in a tomb from about the 9th century. And the other is from, I think, a Middle Bronze Age tomb at Jericho.
Right.
Otherwise,
and Tut's tomb.
And Tut. Okay.
I mean, and because that's the you know, iconic bed of antiquity.
The touchstone.
Right. I mean, I think there are a lot of beds in Egypt in general, but Tut is the best known.
I think it's the earliest.
That could be.
Now, headrests are a different issue, which we'll eventually get into, I assume.
Yeah.
Headrests.
But because headrests imply beds, and we have headrests in Egypt that go back to the early dynastic, I believe.
Right. And the beds could have just been perishable.
Right. Or, you know, like all furniture eventually just got thrown out.
Right. Right.
Right.
Good point. Yeah.
But, okay. So what do we have from Middle Bronze Age? Alex?
Jericho tomb.
Yeah.
With remains of a kind of funerary bed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that these are that wooden beds constructions are kind of expensive and fancy. And because, you know, trying to think of other archaeological examples, from domestic context, I can't really. Obviously, they're not going to be well preserved,
right?
Except maybe in carbonized form. But what you do have are lots and lots of benches.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to eventually get to, is bench tombs, and whether bench tombs can be used as analogs proxies for actual
the sleeping proxy.
Right.
Well, but what does it tell us about where people slept, how people slept?
Well, I mean, this is the other thing. Think about houses in Bronze Age, Iron Age, and the use of space. Because I was always kind of assuming mats that would be rolled up and stashed.
Tatami.
What?
The tatami tradition of Japan.
Okay.
Or even modern day Turkey, where you're just in a room. And it's time to, I mean, this happened to me several times and when I was sort of hitchhiking around Eastern Turkey, that I'd be in the headman's house and it'd be time to sleep. And all of a sudden, all of these mattresses would, you know, appear,
rolled out,
and everybody would just crash.
Huh. See, that's how I've kind of always pictured it for antiquity, that most people just didn't need beds with frames and mattresses, but just mats.
The futon tradition.
Right. Yeah. Basically, some kind of mat.
Yeah.
And even in modern day India, where, you know, space is at a real premium, at the end of the day, the living room just gets tidied up and mats get unfolded and everyone just goes to bed.
Right.
Which bed?
The other thing is, so I looked at a Bible concordance to see.
Better, that's better to go. It's better to go to sleep with a Bible concordance than with a
Well,
television. Because
that's
if
a
I have
good point.
Bible concordance, I should put one on my bed's night table. That'll put me
Well,
to sleep pronto.
I mean, full disclosure, online, so that would be just as bad as the blue light from a TV, I suppose.
Oh.
But in any case, so I went to BibleGateway.com and I looked up references to beds. There are so many references to beds, but like the narratives in which they appear, these are mainly about elites. So, the king's bedchamber and a whole bunch of references like King David's wife Michal hiding an idol in the bed, and then Og, king of Bashan.
Right. He had a big bed.
He had a
He
big
was
bed, exactly,
right.
made of iron, apparently.
Right.
Although I went into a rabbit hole, and there's a whole lot of controversy about how that should be translated,
Right.
but I think iron
The
bed.
iron bed sounds more like a Game of Thrones kind of thing than a biblical kind of thing, but who am I to say?
In any case, what I got from this deep, deep research is that it's clear that the elites had bed frames and beds and mattresses, but that doesn't mean that everybody did.
Right. And that's a right. And that's a question that sort of, initiates a whole bunch of questions. Who was sleeping together, right? Nuclear families all sleeping together, the kids sleeping together. There's this bed from Pompeii and a whole discussion of slave quarters and the slaves sleeping together as both a way of keeping them, giving them some kind of environment to bond, but also a place, also a way of sort of making sure that they all sort of, spy on each other. They're all sort of aware of each other's comings and goings. So in Pompeii, slaves had beds, not just the elite.
Right.
And then I got to thinking of four-room houses and even the modern tradition of Middle Easterners sleeping on the roof.
Oh, good point.
And not clearly not having a bed frame because you have a nice springy turf up there, but in the summertime sleeping on the roof, and we've all probably stayed in hostels where we've slept on the roof in really hot weather, and in current day Baghdad and places like that, they go up to the roof and sleep there. In India, they sleep on the roof.
Or because they didn't have fire escapes to sleep on.
Well,
Distinctly modern
so
invention.
now that we have an iron bed, maybe they did.
That's right.
Well, so the article that you sent the reference to, "Sleep in Human Culture and Evolution" by Bakur et al., is really fascinating, and it was mind expanding for me because the whole idea of co-sleeping, which is culturally very much not American.
Right. And
We've
by
all
that, you can almost say not Western.
not Western. Whereas that was very much the norm, sort of globally until the Industrial Revolution. Segregation of space. People didn't have separate bedrooms, and everybody just sort of bunked down where they were working and living and doing stuff. I think that this is very thought-provoking, and that the bed as a signifier
Oh boy. Oh
signifier,
no. Not
it's the word of the day. Ding, ding, ding.
just the bed is a comfortable place. That's a step up from the millennia before it was first introduced.
Right, sleeping on the dirt. Well, I'm sorry, maybe it's the signified in that case.
I think we have to be careful about this whole symbolic meaning of the bed. I think they're just sleeping on beds.
Okay, well, hold it. Let's let the abstract Let's see what the abstract has to say.
Truth in the abstract bed.
Because you and I, Rachel, are totally on the pragmatic side of this.
That's right. And
Alex, well, I think it tells us something about culture, because in Japan, everybody kind of sleeps in the same, co-sleeping is mm-hmm. much, even today, is much more of a,
right. And,
of a
thing. And South Asia.
And South Asia. And in traditional cultures today, as you noted, Turkey, say, multi-purpose rooms, where you sleep, where you work, are commonplace.
Right.
And so, what are the cultural implications of this for understanding, you know, cultures?
Right.
and how do you do it archaeologically?
Right.
Or should we just adopt that as a baseline?
Sure. No, you're right about that in terms of, you know, are we dealing with nuclear families? Are we dealing with extended families? You know, the thing about the whole Pompeii thing I found fascinating in that, you know, it's not just an elite convention, at least by, you know,
right.
Roman times.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a lot of sort of the whole household archaeology mode of analysis that can be, that would be useful if we had the data. Like the biblical data is very elite driven.
Yeah.
But, you know, the more prosaic, where people are sleeping and how they're sleeping in the, you know, bulk of the population, that's very hard to get at archaeologically, I think.
Yeah, especially again if we're dealing with perishable materials, because even a wooden bed frame, unless it's in a tomb in Jericho, isn't going to survive.
Right. And the question then is, there's another question, which is a lot of our data does come from mortuary texts. Are the two analogous, or are mortuary contexts special and aspirational and different? And you know,
gosh, I wish I had a bed, but I'll get one maybe when I'm dead.
Right.
If I'm lucky.
Or only the dead get to rest on a nice bed.
Right.
So that gets to that abstract that you were talking about, Alex. Yes, there's a bed or evidence for a bed in an MB tomb at Jericho, but that doesn't mean that the bulk of the population of Jericho was sleeping on beds.
Right, right.
They wouldn't know what to do with a bed.
Maybe if they didn't know what to do with it, maybe they'd be sleeping under the bed. And keeping junk on top of the bed.
Right. And that's, you know, anytime you find an installation in an archaeological context, how can you tell if it's multi-purpose or single purpose? If right. there's a bench and it has, you know, remains of animal bones or you know, some sort of food remains. Well, I haven't eaten in bed in a while myself.
Mm.
Although my daughter told me this morning that she had breakfast in bed. Just eating her yogurt and granola before she got up.
Well, the problem is that once you get out of bed,
yeah,
you know, and prepare a meal, she's going to get climb back into bed.
Well, it depends on. I once lived in a studio apartment for several years, and the main feature was this Murphy bed that you pulled down. And I think, and the TV was in front of the bed. And I think I, yeah.
You're really connected to the TV.
Right, I am for sure. And I think, you know, I ate in bed because A, it was a comfortable seat, and B, it was in front of the TV. So I think if you're talking about, let's say, well, you mentioned four room houses. So if you're talking about Iron Age houses where rooms are multifunctional, then it's entirely possible you'll be eating in the beds as well as sleeping and resting and whatever.
But the big question is, did they have beds? And again, they're certainly sleeping. They're probably sleeping on the roofs in warm weather. And in during the fall and winter, it's a good question of where they slept.
Yeah.
Especially if they had the critters inside.
That
means there's less space for furniture.
But more body heat in the cold
weather. Right, plenty of heat, but still less space for furniture in general. And it kind of, because obviously they're not wandering all around the first floor, but, you know, just in a separated area. Can we talk about headrests? Because
Sure.
that's where we have the most archaeological information, though it is, you know, the bulk of it is from Egypt.
Culturally specific.
Right.
So, well, what do you want to say about them?
Well, the first thing I want to say is I want to commend, there was one article in which the Egyptologist who was sort of being interviewed for this, or actually maybe she wrote it, you know, test drove these headrests. And so it was kind of, I give her a lot of credit for figuring out that you how to position your head and what kinds of positions you could sleep in. And then she came to the conclusion that they're comfortable because headrests look incredibly uncomfortable.
They do. They do.
Right?
They look like speaker stands.
Yes, they do look sort of like speaker stands.
And I don't understand how she could conclude that they're comfortable. It's got to hurt your neck.
Worked on them.
Experimental archaeology.
Yeah. Right. She did come to the conclusion that they were not for the neck, but we call them headrests. So
but,
I think
they are so tall. I mean, how?
Tall.
Yeah. So it's got to hurt your neck because your head is so high above the rest of your body.
I can send you the, did I think I sent you the link. There are pictures of her.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't.
Yeah. And she said it's comfortable. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing where you literally have to try it.
I guess so.
It looks so uncomfortable.
It does. It really does.
Right. And so it's very counterintuitive, but it might be one of those counterintuitive things where, oh, you know what? This isn't so bad. But the fact that there's so many of them and they date very early, right? Sometime in the third millennium, let's say second half of the third millennium, that suggests that at least for the elites in some of these societies,
I think there's a very simple explanation, really, that if you're living in a society, specifically Egypt, and early on, and you're expending all of this time and energy building enormous monuments where you have to lift your neck up, you're going to need some neck support when you go to sleep.
Yes, so.
Well, one of the things that she suggested and raised was that in hot climates, the separation of the head allows airflow.
Right. I read that somewhere.
Right. So
what do you think of that?
I think that's important because as someone who sleeps hot, I go to great lengths to be cool, in hot weather. And they do include, you know, sort of getting my head a little bit higher and, you know, positioning in a way so that there's, if not airflow, at least not total head compression.
I am known to flip my pillows in the middle of the night to get onto the cool side.
Sure. I think that's a very common thing. So that I thought resonated, like, oh yeah, these headrests. And then she also suggested they might have been padded. And
right.
I had never thought of that, but yeah, that's probably pretty obvious. Well,
seeing as how they are made of wood.
Or stone.
Or stone.
A lot of them are stone.
To be
close to comfortable, they would need padding. Yeah. I never thought about the whole air circulation thing seriously at all. I also sleep cold, so I want as much heat as I can get. I've been
you
known
would not use a headrest.
Yeah, I don't want the headrest. I want to put my head under the covers. I want to just be warm.
Right.
Yeah, so that didn't resonate for me, but I guess most of the world wants air to circulate.
I think this also speaks to a broader question, and that's the cultural construction of comfort.
Oh.
Wow. So culture. So agreed. Comfort is absolutely subjective, absolutely constructed, but there's also some objective aspects to comfort, like nobody sleeps on their heads. Some people can sleep standing up, but it's only because they have some kind of horrible condition. It's not by choice, you know.
Right. And nobody that we know of sleeps like on a bed of glass.
Right. Or nobody, people don't, people can, I, you know, people can take naps and people can sleep in a seated position. We all have.
Right.
We've slept in cars and things like that, but that's foisted on us. It's certainly not a choice. So I think there is sort of an objective aspect to sleep slash comfort in that we want to be lying down.
Yeah.
Okay, you want to be lying down, but do you want to be lying down on something hard or something soft?
Well,
Do you want to be
depends on your back.
warm, or do you
Right.
want to
Right, be cooler.
be cooler? And is this are there biological is there a biological kind of range that has to be met? Or is demonstrating that you can sleep anywhere, anytime, on anything, a kind of cultural ideal for you? If you're a Spartan, I don't know.
Right, then it would be cool to be able to sleep anywhere. Good point.
Right.
Right. I mean, right. And again, not because I've wanted to, and I probably am somewhat speaking for all of us, but we sleep on trains, overnight trains, and we sleep on the decks of ferries and things like that. We've all done those kinds of things, but they're not choices. And if I at those when I was doing that, if I could have afforded a sleeper car or a stateroom, I would have done that.
Right, but
So,
how, what about if something is too soft? It's the Goldilocks
okay,
paradox.
Goldilocks, yeah.
Right. Okay, so I'm sure you guys have done this too. When you're on an excavation and you've been in the hot sun for 6 or 8 hours, and you come back to the room you're staying in, have you just laid down on the wonderful, cool, flat, hard floor and fallen asleep? Am I
No.
the only
No, I've not done that.
one? Really? Because you don't want to get into the bed and get the bed all filthy with your dirty clothes, so you lie down on the floor. Well, I
No,
would.
I can see that.
Very comfortable,
I
hard.
think that's a decision that one makes. Like, I'm so tired and so hot, I don't care
Okay.
about, right? And then you just lie down, and then at night it's like, oh, this is really gross. But again, at night you're tired and
Right.
well, and that's also that also leads to another question about the cultural parameters of gross environments,
Right. Would
namely
people wait
like
to be written?
bugs and critters, and which would have been endemic,
Right.
and the all the things that go along with comfort. I mean, there's a like a complicated triangular equation between comfort and grossness and necessity, that and economic viability. I don't know.
Right.
Right. Well, I mean, that brings us back to elites versus non-elites. And, if the non-elites are sleeping on some sort of mat that they roll and unroll, they're on the floor with the bugs and the dung and everything else. And it's the elites who are in the beds. They're elevated. They don't have all the critters. Where was I
Yeah,
going with
but
that?
you're still sleeping on a mattress that's stuffed with hay and
Yeah. Right.
whatever.
There was that one article or one reference to the concept of ticking, of
Yes.
these very tight woven, not sheets, but tight woven, bags that would that get filled with all of the kinds of things you were just talking about that would, Alex, that would stick out and poke out and things like that. And so there you have even the notion of technological development based on, the need for greater comfort while you're asleep. Like, I need a tighter weave stat because I can't get a good night's sleep. And, you textile producers, you need to come up with something.
Right.
I should have said weavers, but, I'm so
Believers.
addled.
Well, that puts me in mind of possibly one of my favorite TV commercials of all time, because it starred Joey Heatherton for
Oh boy.
the perfect sleeper. And I can still fondly visualize her. Anyway, neither
Moving
here nor there.
right along. Yeah. As
With
quickly as we can.
a
I want to
special.
bring up this. We talk about lot, all of these societies in the ancient Near East at least had a component of pastoralism. And pastoralists just go out with the herds. And they either sleep on the ground, or maybe they'll have some kind of bedroll. But bedrolls generally imply you're schlepping something, which means you have a, we think of bedrolls with cowboys and horses. But these pastoralists, they didn't have horses. They didn't have any of that. They just had whatever they were going to carry. So I think that they were just sleeping on the ground and, had, I don't know, not a rock for a pillow, but probably just stuffed a bag that they did carry with something and used that as a pillow. So if they were able to sleep on the ground for, whatever it was, 6 months a year, on or off throughout the year, then when they got back to the four-room house, I think they could easily just continue to sleep on the floor or on the roof.
Well, but this also begs the question of technological development or necessity that drives technological development. It goes back to the history of textiles, or the prehistory of textiles.
One of your favorite topics.
It is one of my favorite
I
topics.
know. Awesome.
And so if you were 1 million years BC, another fine image of Raquel Welch wearing the
All right. That's a
but
70s adolescent deep dives.
but skin the use of skins and furs preceded textiles,
Right.
and certain environment and until hair and wool could be utilized and in some form and processed into clothing, then certain kinds of behaviors weren't really possible, and other certain kinds of environments may not have been fully accessible, at least all year round. And accompanying notions of how you sleep, where you sleep, were conditioned by this, because until you could have a bedroll, you slept on a fur of some kind, or a pelt, and so on.
So that's an interesting question. So why in the Middle Ages were they stuffing these things with hay instead of wool? Was wool too expensive? Because now, of course, the big thing is to use things like wool, especially, if you have allergies and all sorts of things. And then the issue with wool not meeting all sorts of strictures for, fire retardant materials in beds, which is a huge contemporary bed, issue in the West at least. So why weren't they just stuffing all these things with wool instead of, materials that would, be more problematic and stick out and, be painful?
Really good question. I don't have an answer.
I don't know, except that in different periods you have industrial sized wool production, and other periods you don't. And that's contingent on broader economic kinds of things. But that would also be largely invisible archaeologically, at least.
Right.
Unless you did some kind of micro analysis of soils and residues and protein analyses and stuff like that. So in the future, it might actually be possible just to take a soil sample from a four-room house or something that's just filled with dirt, and the boffins could tell you exactly what they
All right,
were
everyone take a drink.
sleep what they were sleeping on or putting on that surface. But I want to talk about it about something else briefly that's related, and that's biphasic sleeping. This whole notion that cultures are waking, people are waking up in the middle of the night and actually doing stuff. And this is very apropos, because last night at 2:30, I woke up because I had one sentence in my head
Oh no.
that I had to write down.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
I haven't even looked at it yet, but then I put it into my phone, and then obviously I'm up for an hour checking the mail, but I'm lying there flat as a board, and you know, I'm on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, looking around at all the bad news, doom scrolling. But this is a very common kind of thing that in every culture, you wake up in the middle of the night and you're like doing stuff, right, and chatting, and you're accomplishing tasks. And my question is, culturally and also archaeologically, how would we know? Culturally doesn't matter. Or do we just accept that as the baseline that, you know, people, pre-industrial people, did that?
You can't find it archaeologically. You're not going to find any evidence of people waking up in the middle of the night archaeologically. I don't know.
Does it matter?
Well, I was going to raise an issue which actually now is somewhat related, which is how much sleep did people need in antiquity? Mm. Now we're being told by, I'll use your term, the boffins, that for mental acuity and health, we should be getting 7 hours of sleep.
Right.
And I suspect uninterrupted sleep.
Uninterrupted sleep.
Yeah, not like two and one.
Right.
So, and of course, in antiquity, you know, we're not really, what's the right word? Calibrating properly. Because nightfall in antiquity was a big deal, being as you only had small oil lamps.
Right.
So what's the point of staying up, right?
Right.
You're not going to be doom scrolling. You're not going to be reading. You're not, most people aren't even literate. You're not going to be, you know, telling the same story over and over again after you've already told it three times that night. Right. So with nightfall, you're probably going to be winding down. And right. Then if you're going to be sleeping until sunrise, provided you're not waking up in the middle of the night and doing things, that's a long time.
It is a long time. Yeah. Right?
That's easily, you know, can be between 8 and 10 to, you know, 5 to 6.
Yeah.
But if it's 8 to 6, that's a crazy amount of sleep.
Sleep, right, right.
I mean, I haven't gotten that much sleep since.
Yeah, really.
Compared to modern societies, or most modern societies, people were probably more tired physically because there was a whole lot more tasks. Well,
they're doing stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Just typing.
Right. But I mean, I wonder if people had issues with insomnia.
This one of these articles talked about a Shakespearean reference to insomnia from Henry V, Part 2. I won't read it, and Sonnet 27. So, okay.
So sure.
I can't. It's not a contemporary.
I think
issue,
and it's aggravated contemporary world because there's so much to worry about. But
I think in the prehistoric world, you know, when you're hearing the wolves outside the cave, you're probably worried about some stuff, and
that's true.
The bears want their cave back, that sort of thing. But the idea of getting up in the middle of the night and actually doing stuff, like, okay, I'm up, I'm going to nap some flints.
I'm going to put on, you know, I'm going to start, you know, getting the yogurt going.
Right. I'm going to tell this yarn again.
Well, on the other hand, though, if you're sleeping proximate to your animals, they might, they don't give a, they don't care about anything. So they might be waking you up. Kids might be waking you up. One thing I wanted to raise, I mean, actually, you know, there's so much to talk about.
I know. It's pretty amazing.
I know. It really is. Think about sites like Çatalhöyük and Işıklıhöyük. I mean, those are very small domestic spaces, especially if the family size was pretty big, but you had a huge flat roof. But Çatal and Işıklı, you know, they have serious winters. So you're not going to be sleeping on the roof up in the winter,
right.
Which meant that that's a very small domestic area. And undoubtedly, that's the kind of thing that we're talking about with Japan and South Asia, where just the mats come out at night, everyone's on top of each other. And then that begs, of course, the question that we haven't really touched on at all in this kind of context is, intimacy and that whole thing. So yeah, there's a lot to
And as any person older than us certainly knows, what happens, I gotta go.
Right.
I'm gonna climb up the ladder.
Right.
I'm gonna walk across 23 roofs.
Right.
To get to the edge of Chattel Town. Then I'm gonna come back. And I'm gonna try not to climb down the wrong ladder.
Well, yeah, there you go, right? That's the total suburban, dilemma of like literally walking into the wrong house because everything looks the same.
Right. If you're talking about communal sleeping and you get up in the middle of the night for any of these reasons, you're going to wake up everybody else.
Right. And they're going to yell and get pissed off.
Right.
And then, of course, you're walking on the roof. Everybody in town can hear you.
Well, that's a good point, too. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's that whole thing, that whole urban template is fraught with peril.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's not an urban template, whatever, settlement template.
Right. But that's why they eventually put the roads on the ground.
Yeah. Bad idea.
It's a huge leap forward for humanity when you could just like walk to the front door and,
Right.
Yeah.
Don't say it.
No, but I'm thinking it.
All right.
All right. Final thoughts?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. How to, what constitutes and how to get a good night's sleep in antiquity.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did they get a good night's sleep in antiquity?
Well, maybe they didn't. I mean, maybe that was, they weren't living past 40. Maybe sleep deprivation, contributed to disease. And so.
Maybe a long history of bad sleep has led to the chaos of contemporary society.
Could be.
Yeah, how much sleep did Kafka get?
Kafka didn't get any sleep. He was up all night with what's her name writing.
Yeah, that's true.
Look what it did to him.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
don't be like Kafka, kids.
That's a good place to end it.
Probably right. A good place.
Very good. Yeah.
Okay.
If he only had a waterbed.
But he was in the insurance industry. He would have known that waterbeds just too much trouble, a lot of trouble.
That's true. You check the actuarial tables.
Right. I think there's a biblical prescription against, flooding the home of your neighbor without cause.
All right.
All right.
Well, this episode has me yearning for a nice long nap. I'm sure you feel the same way. But before that, we'd like to thank our music director, Erez Dessel, for our theme music. Look for his performances in the Chicago area and beyond. Follow him and his music on Instagram at 54BPM. We'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Dumont Television Network, a division of Yoyodyne Propulsion Systems. Be sure to catch Monodrama Theater, weeknights at 11, if you're up. Anywho, to get in touch, leave us a comment right here or hit the little heart-shaped button because hearts mean love. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at ThisAncient and on Facebook or contact us via email at ThisWeekInTheAncientNeareast, it's all one word, at gmail.com or send us a postcard at P.O. Box 1177, Boston, Mass. 02134.